Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Priscilla Torres.
So welcome to Ivy Podcast. I am your host, Priscilla Torres, and I am excited to be joined today by Wade Thomas, who is a change maker and influencer in the HR community today. Wade Thomas has over 20 years of experience in leadership and talent management. He is previously the CHRO for Meritage Homes Corporate and is presently the founder and principal for Aim to Win. Wade, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and excited to talk with you today.
Awesome. So I must share, Wade, I am very excited to have you here today for numerous reasons. One is, you know, we've had opportunities to have some great discussions that have led up to today's meeting. And you share a passion not only on human resources, on leadership philosophies, and the not so new way of leading with empathy and compassion. So I'm just excited to just dive deep and talk more about that. So when we look at different leadership styles, there's of course transformational, transactional, servant leadership. There's all these different leadership styles. Can you share a little bit more about this concept of heart-based leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I mean when I say heart-based leadership is it's really a leadership style that features compassion and empathy. And, you know, as I went through my career, it's always been part of what I've tried to do as a leader. And what I found is it works. You know, maybe it was the way I was brought up, maybe it wasn't, but the reason that I really continued to develop it was simply that it works. I found that I gained a lot more loyalty, a lot more engagement, people were more comfortable to innovate. I lost one person my entire career to a voluntary termination, and yet I was seen as a challenging leader. Mm-hmm. And so I found all that. But as I went through my career, what I found is that using the words compassion and empathy, or you know, even more so using words like love, like kindness, was just seen as soft and weak. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we hear is when we think of compassion, empathy in Western business today is, well, that's soft. That's all about ice cream and pony rides. We're all about results here. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things I really try to do is refute that. Because really what I mean when I say heart-based leadership or heart-based culture is it's words like integrity, mm-hmm. respect, teamwork, caring, fairness, inclusion, things like that. So it's just really all about this belief that everybody on your team belongs to that team. It's almost like a family. And because of this, you operate from a baseline assumption that others are both capable and that they're acting in the interest of the team. So contrast that with organizations that really go at it from a different direction, right? So a lot of organizations will look at it and they will assume that people are untrustworthy or they're lazy or they're not competent enough. And so contrast those two approaches, right? The second approach really means a lot of systems, a lot of controls, competition, things like that. Whereas in a heart-based concept where you believe that people are skilled and competent and they have your best interests at heart, what happens is you get a higher level of trust at all levels of the organization. And the big thing that leads to is that I really want to drive home is it really leads to sustainable competitive advantage for businesses. When you have that environment of trust, when you have that environment of compassion and empathy, what happens is you get loyalty, deep loyalty. You get engagement, you get excitement, you get innovation. And think about it even beyond your employees. The impact that you have on your customer when you have that environment of compassion and empathy is so powerful. And that's really what heart-based leadership is all about.
And I couldn't agree with you more. Now more than ever, since we've been operating in a more remote and a distant space where we're not working alongside with our staff, it's so important to be able to foster that culture of trust and that culture of understanding, having that leading with our hearts, leading with empathy and compassion. So when we look at our own organizations and we identify some potential gaps, how can an organization start to build and foster that culture of heart-based philosophies?
You know, there's really two directions to go there. There's two levels that you have to deal with. The first thing is really you got to start with leadership. Mm-hmm. You know, your leader, you need to develop your leaders. You need to teach them these skills. By the way, compassion, empathy is a learned trait. It's not innate. You know, it's something you can learn, you know, given the right amount of time, coaching, development, whatever it might be. So it really starts with developing leaders and teaching them what it looks like. And by the way, a lot of them already have it. So it's all about activating it in those cases. And that gets to really the second point is it's really environmentally within your culture is creating that really that environment that compassion and empathy can thrive, can exist, where it's just not seen as a bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it really does start with making leaders comfortable, encouraging them, rewarding them, things like that. Also, another big part of developing an environment is really the concept of psychological safety. Mm-hmm. And there's, yeah, and there's just a lot starting to happen about psychological safety and geez, a couple hundred years too late. but it's great that it's out there now. And that's really the idea that people think the organization has their best interest in heart. Mm-hmm. They feel safe to raise their hand, whether it be to point out something that's wrong, but more importantly, to point out something that could be, to point out possibilities, to really feel free to innovate in an environment where they're not gonna get crushed for failing. Mm-hmm. You know, a comfort in experimenting. That's what really moves businesses forward. And so how can you do it today? How could you really go into an organization? Today is you really gotta create that environment. Mm-hmm. You gotta do things like spot it, look for, you know, opportunities to reward compassion, empathy. You need to tell stories. Storytelling is a huge thing and probably one of the most impactful things you can do in a culture or in a business. Mm-hmm. And you need to find these stories of compassion, empathy, tell the story and really build on it. You need to make it part of your daily routine. Mm-hmm. You want people talking about this when they're in the kitchen, you know, when we get to the days where we can be in the kitchen again.
I know, right?
but not only that, you know, I say that a little bit lightly, but you know what? You want that to be the conversation on Slack. You want that to be the conversation, you know, on Zoom, on Teams, whatever it might be. You want people feeling free to talk about compassion, empathy. And people aren't going to feel free until leaders start doing it openly. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important part of it. And the last thing I would say about, you know, how you can really start making that impact in the organization is make it fun. Mm-hmm. You know, to go out there and, you know, I think we all like structure, you know, structure and formal things makes us comfortable. I've talked about that, mm-hmm. but that's boring to go out there and try to roll out a heart-based culture, a heart-based leadership through checklists, through policies and procedures is really going about the wrong way. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to make it fun. You want to make it just part of life. Mm-hmm. You don't want to make it just a check the box kind of exercise.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. And now more than ever, as I had referenced before, psychological safety and leading through these different kinds of philosophies are so important for organizations to be sustainable long-term. But I look at the opposite side is what if there is not a culture of leading with these philosophies and a sense of psychological safety? What can one do to promote that or bring it up to leaders who maybe, you know, have more traditional ways of leading their teams and leading their organization? Any tips that you can share with our audience?
Yeah, you know, a big part of that is really understanding why. Mm-hmm. So why do they go about, you know, the traditional old school way? You know, and there's a lot of different whys there. So you need to understand which one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one why is they believe that's the way to get things done. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, that's just been drilled in all our heads, right? The way to get things done is accountability. is, which by the way, you can have accountability in a heart-based culture, and you should.
Yes.
But it's all about accountability. Or, you know, I always like to tell a story. You know, I worked with a CEO years ago, and you know, gets in front of a town hall meeting and says, "There's two motivators, mm-hmm. fear and greed." And so we have this mindset that's just been built over decades that fear and greed really is what motivates people. And, you know, there's a lot of research that says it's not. And so when you have that, when you have, you know, leadership that believes that fear and greed and old style leadership is how to get things done, what you really need to do is convince them otherwise. Is, you know, you need to tie it to results. You know, a lot of times you have to be careful with this because you can't really tell them that. A lot of times you can't really show the research. They've got to learn on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so showing results, showing case studies, or even showing little parts in your organization, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times you can pilot this in a small group without anybody knowing. And then all of a sudden you have a star performing group and this question starts getting asked, what's different?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being able to kind of overcome that. Another possible why out there is they don't know any other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way they've been brought up. That's the way they've been taught. That's the way they've, you know, been developed over the course of their careers. And that becomes really an exercise in training and coaching and, you know, giving them those tools.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways that's easier because you're not overcoming these deep-seated beliefs.
Absolutely. And when we look at talent within our workforce, you know, we sometimes are very quick to put boxes around our talent. What are some thoughts on common practices that we can do to eliminate those prior biases or prior practices that we've created within our workforce of putting people in boxes?
So I'm a big believer that the boxes limit just by definition.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to understand why we get there. So the human mind is really programmed to think in terms of boxes. You know, so, you know, it's programmed to take people and categorize, or not just people, to take information in general, categorize it, generalize it, whatever it may be, because we have so much information flying at us that that's just an easier way to do it. So you have to break that, you know, and you really have to start educating and pointing out the differences, you know, that people have and what that means. What are the implications? So it's one thing to understand that, you know, somebody really doesn't fit in that box. Okay, that's fine. What does that mean? And what could it mean? What could the possibilities be of having people outside of boxes? And, you know, there's a lot of examples, you know, of situations where people, when they let out of the box, they really excel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really important to really bring that to light, to understand that, you know, boxes are by definition limiting. And do we really want our organizations to be limited?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. If you ask that question in a vacuum, by the way, if you ask any CEO out there, any executive out there, do you want your organization limited? You know, nine times out of 10, the answer is going to be no. So why are you doing it?
So then what are some thoughts on how to remove those limitations? So is it the thought of like free autonomy and allowing employees to really explore ways to enhance their own positions, or what are some thoughts and some strategies around breaking down those boxes that we've created?
So, you know, I'm a big believer in the concept of, and this will be in a book that I'm releasing next month, but the idea that you put heart-based and compassion ahead of requirements, ahead of compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because think about what we do in organizations. You know, we start off small, you know, so we have a small business, maybe you're a solopreneur, whatever it is, the entrepreneur business, you just do stuff, you get stuff done, right? Then as we get bigger, we start putting policies in, and then we start putting procedures in, and then we start putting handbooks in, and then we start putting job titles in, and, you know, and then job descriptions and all that kind of stuff. Every step you make down that path, and I'm not saying there's not any merit to it, because as you get a big organization, you have to do some of it. Every incremental step you take limits the organization more. I believe that nothing hurts an organization more than bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, and the more you add in, the more it's limiting. And so to answer your question, you know, I'm going to kind of share a conversation. So it's an ongoing conversation I've been having with a CEO friend of mine here in Arizona, and runs a company that is very engineering focused. And, you know, and engineers, I've been working with them for decades. A lot of times they really like their processes, procedures, and so forth. He's done away with all that. Mm. You know, and he puts it really well. So I'm going to steal his words here. But when you have, you know, handbooks or policies or procedures, whatever it is in your organization, you're really managing to the lowest common denominator. So what he says is that basically it creates reversion to the mean. So will those systems help your lower end employees, help your employees that really, you know, maybe aren't good fits? Yeah, it'll help bring them to the mean. But it's also going to bring your high performers and your high potentials to the mean. So you're going to bring them down. And his point is, I would rather just deal, you know, with the low end in a different way. You know, whether that be, you know, getting new employees or training or development or whatever it might be, I would rather deal with that than slow down my high performers. And so think about your processes, your procedures, whatever it is. Are they helping you? Are they necessary? Or are they just getting in the way? And you'll find that, you know, it's probably a mix. You know, I'm not a believer in, you know, the words always or never, but, you know, it's a mix. And so get those things out of the way that are blocking your people, that are creating barriers, and that are boxing them in.
Yeah, you said something that was really important, because I think inadvertently sometimes by putting people in boxes and setting all these regimens and processes, because there's a law and order, right, of a process of how things should operate in an organization. But when we're looking at our talent, oftentimes I find in my experience that we spend our majority of our time working on our low performers. And by inputting all of our efforts and all of our focus on our low performers, we're neglecting the other processes that we've put in place. We're neglecting allowing the high performers to really just continue to expand, because we put everybody in a box. We make assumptions that, you know, a process is broken, not necessarily because the process is broken, but more so is because we may not be having a conversation about the low performers who are driving that outcome. So it was interesting that you mentioned that. And I commend your colleague for being able to think outside the box and look at these new progressive ways that we can really drive results with our staff, looking at alternative ways to lead our staff and give that and then that sense of autonomy, so they can flourish and do well in their role and ultimately impact the overall organization. So that is phenomenal feedback. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I know that leaders today, you know, we're ultimately faced with consistent directional changes. We're living in unprecedented times where we've had to adapt quickly to what I like to call the modern workforce. And failure is often inevitable, right? So what are your thoughts on failure within an organization and failures on a leadership level?
So I think we got to start with, you know, kind of dealing with the word failure. And failure has gotten a lot of attention, at least in my space over the last couple of years, you know, being that failure is really a good thing. You know, I mean, that's not really new thinking. But when you get into organizations and you get at the high levels, they don't see failure as a good thing. The reason why is because failure is too broad a term. There's really three types of failures you can have. You can have learning failure, which is basically failure that, you know, you took a chance, you experimented, it didn't work out, you learned from it, and you advanced the organization. So that's really positive failure that you can grow from, and it's something that, you know, you want to create that environment that allows that. Mm-hmm. There's also circumstantial failure. So circumstantial failure, a lot of businesses failed over the last 6 months, not from anything they did, but from the COVID. Mm-hmm. And so that's circumstantial failure. So nothing that, you know, the leader could have done would have changed the outcome there. Mm-hmm. So it's still a failure, and we don't want to celebrate that failure, but it's not something you're going to learn from, nor is it something that you really, you know, need to discipline or go after. And there's a third type of failure, and this is the one that I think top levels of leadership really struggle with, you know, celebrating, and that is preventable failure. This is when you intentionally do something outside the realm of what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you go outside the process, you go outside, you know, the mission, you go outside the vision of the company, and you fail. You know, are there some learnings from that? Yeah, absolutely. But this is not something that you as a leadership team necessarily want to celebrate, mm-hmm. right? And because, you know, you want your people to feel safe to fail. That's a big deal because that's where innovation comes. That's where all that comes. Mm-hmm. But when you intentionally fail, basically, that's not the same kind of thing. And so that's a way that, you know, you can really reconcile it. If you're a leader, reconcile it in your mindset. It's just understanding that there's, you know, three different types of failure, and you don't, what happens is leaders often will throw every failure into that preventable bucket. Mm-hmm. And then, so when you do have good failure, then people get punished. They don't feel safe.
Yeah.
And so what you really want to be doing as a leader is, you know, finding those instances of learning failure, mm-hmm. and then putting a, you know, a method in place or a mindset in place that we're going to accept that, but we're going to learn from it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to advance the organization. Preventable failure, on the other hand, you know, we're not going to tolerate. And by the way, when it comes to psychological safety, because that's a question I get a lot is, well, how can you not tolerate preventable failure and still have psychological safety? Well, the reality is people aren't robots. People aren't computer algorithms. People are pretty smart. They know what's going on, and they understand the concept of, you know, of not tolerating preventable failure. Mm-hmm. So by really differentiating between these types of failure, then you can create that environment where you can encourage growth, you can encourage innovation, experimentation, all those kind of things, yet still discourage flat out going against the company vision.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you had mentioned that you're writing a book. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're writing about?
Yeah, so I'm writing about the heart-based, you know, how to create, you know, a heart-based culture in a practical way. And so, you know, I really get at, you know, basically eight principles, you know, of, you know, of what that means and what the heart-based culture is. So it really kind of comes with, you know, creating the environment, you know, that allows people to really excel, making hard decisions, which is really, you know, that's an interesting one, right? Because like I mentioned earlier, when we think of compassion and empathy and heart and love and kindness, we don't think about things like hard decisions. We assume that we don't make those hard decisions. We don't fire people. But that's absolutely a key principle, you know, of heart-based leadership is you have to do that because it benefits everybody else and it benefits the recipient. Mm-hmm. You know, it really does. People don't like to fail over and over and over again in their jobs.
Absolutely.
You know, if they're a bad fit, they're not happy either. And so being compassionate often involves making hard decisions. You know, the book talks about using influence over authority, you know, how, you know, relying on a hierarchy and relying on authority is really not a very effective approach. Talks about not tolerating negative behavior. Now, that's one of my favorite parts of the book, actually, because so often we tolerate negative behavior. And maybe a lot of listeners out there might say, nah, but we do. And here's where we do it. We tolerate bad behavior, negative behavior, when it comes from our high performers. Mm-hmm. And I love to tell this story, so I'm gonna do it here. You know, I once worked with a leader of a sales organization, and you know, sales organizations it's very cut and dried who the high performers are. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the high performers often do things that you don't like as an organization that just are toxic behaviors. And so he took a stand. He tried it out. You know, he fired a high performer. You know, he had somebody that was getting about 40% of his sales.
Wow.
He fired them because they were just a jerk. They were very toxic. And he tells a story. What he found out is that when he did that, not only did the rest of the team pick up those sales, they went beyond it.
Wow.
And so he had some fear going in, but he bit the bullet and did it. And then it became a practice. Then he did it over and over and over again. And I love to tell that story because it is true. Mm-hmm. Because the toxic behaviors, the non-heart-based behaviors will drag on an organization more than the gain you get from most high performers. So I talk a lot about that. Talk about communicating with compassion and empathy. I talk a lot about having an abundant mindset. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of, you know, the old school fear and greed, toxic type of leadership that's out there comes from a place of scarcity. It comes from a place of fear, you know, there's just not enough. You know, think about how a leader that works from a scarcity mindset works. Well, I can't give you credit because there's only so much to go around and I need to take it, mm-hmm. right? Things like that. Whereas if you have an abundant mindset, if you believe that, you know, there's enough of things, you know, then you're going to be gracious. You're going to give out the credit. You're going to help. Your whole focus will be on helping other people get better. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time on that. I mentioned earlier, you know, the idea of compassion over requirements, you know, an important part. And then the eighth principle that I have in there is learning from others. So something leaders often struggle with is they struggle with like learning from others and taking advice because they're the leader. So they're expected in their minds to know everything. And the leaders that really can make a difference are the ones that understand and are open to learning from others, even people that work underneath them, you know, and being able to be open to that and understand that their team growth is only as strong as their own growth. You know, you can't grow your team beyond yourself. And so that's really kind of, that's a gist of what I talk about in the book.
Absolutely. And it sounds very interesting. What is the name of the book?
So it's Heart-Based Culture, a practical guide to building compassion, empathy into your culture.
Nice. So congratulations. It sounds very interesting. I hope I can have the opportunity to read it as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll make sure you get a copy, but I'm excited because I think it can make a real difference within organizations and our success.
Absolutely. And you talk about such relevant topics and topics that we necessarily need to enhance on. And it's like you mentioned before, we all need to be lifetime learners. These are all skills and abilities that we need to just keep gauging and improving on as leaders of our own organization so that we can continue to make an impact to our staff, an impact to our own organizations, and continue to develop professionally. So I commend you for continuing to be a change maker, as I had mentioned before, in our community. And when we look at any individuals that are trying to break the ceiling or are challenging the status quo, what advice could you give to those individuals on what to do?
You know, first of all, be right. I'm just kidding. So that's a very interesting question because I spent my entire career, you know, whether it was, you know, in my early leadership roles to my HR roles, to my executive roles, to, you know, to my role as a founder and CEO now, you know, I really, you know, challenge the status quo. It's what I do. I consider myself a bit of a rebel, but the reason I do that, well, it's probably built into my DNA, but also that's how you move things forward. Mm-hmm. That's how you move organizations forward. And, you know, the reason people often don't do that is they work from that fear space. And, you know, they're really afraid to buck the status quo. And my biggest advice is start thinking about it from an abundance mindset. So think about it from, you know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, maybe I get fired. By the way, that hardly ever happens. I guess if you do it over and over and over again and you get into preventable failures and stuff like that, that could happen. But what I have found in my career, every time I buck the status quo, maybe it wasn't comfortable for me. Maybe I got pushback. Maybe I got yelled at, you know, but I never got fired for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and more often than not, later on, you know, I was recognized for it. And so even if you get fired, you know, if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to buck the status quo, there's going to be other things out there for you. And so a big part of it is having the confidence. The second big part of it is choose your spots. You know, there's a time and place for it. Mm-hmm. You know, I was well regarded by my last CEO, you know, because I was one of the few people in the organization that was willing to push back on him to challenge the status quo. And he liked that. Mm-hmm. Now, did that mean he didn't, you know, yell at me and stuff like that? No. But also when I bucked the status quo, I did it in his office or in my office. I didn't do it at a town hall meeting. You know, I didn't do anything major at a staff meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, I bucked the status quo in areas where it wasn't going to create a need for him to be defensive. Mm-hmm. So you want to be able to buck the status quo and you want to do it in a situation where you're not putting somebody on defense mm-hmm. in front of a bunch of people. And so picking your spots is very, very important. But the big thing is having that confidence in doing that because we don't change. Mm-hmm. We don't improve as organizations without somebody bucking the status quo. And by the way, I can give a lot of examples of situations where people didn't, you know, Blockbuster.
Yeah.
you know, look at these big box retailers that are gone. Mm-hmm. People that were just, you know, afraid to challenge the status quo. Mm-hmm. As an organization who didn't create that safety for them, you know, they went away.
Absolutely. So now more than ever, do we need to look inside of our own organization, our own practices, the way that we lead our staff and lead ourselves so that we can set ourselves up for success and continue to adapt and change to all the inevitable situational items that may come our way that we just have to be resilient and ready for. So I appreciate your honesty. This has been phenomenal. Appreciate your time and providing us with such, you know, great examples and great philosophies that we should all look at incorporating into our own leadership styles. Any closing remarks before we close today's session?
Yeah, you know, the big thing that I really want the listeners to take to heart is go out there and do it. And as leaders, take a look at yourself. Are you challenging the status quo? If not, you know, think about doing it. If you are, ask yourself the next question. Am I the only one? Mm-hmm. If I'm the only one, why? Am I creating an environment where people underneath me can challenge the status quo? And, you know, really what I'm after with this whole, you know, heart-based leadership thing is I believe there's a real opportunity for businesses to change. I really believe that businesses can become sustainable and have this huge competitive advantage. They can take it, just really take this shift and build that culture. I'm also available to help. You know, I have the book coming out in October, so look for that. I build this into all my executive coaching, consulting, and things like that. And I'm going to be coming out with some digital courses early next year as well. So I really encourage people to take this to heart and really start thinking in these terms and what it could mean for their organization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again, Wade, for your time and providing us with this insight. And if anyone would like to reach out to you, what's the best way? Would you have a website or something that our listeners can reach out to?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a website. It's www.aimtowinllc.com. I have, I'm also active on LinkedIn. So you can find me with my name and my, you know, there's a lot of Wade Thomases out there, surprisingly, but you can find it in my company name as well. And then also on Instagram underneath my name. So
wonderful. Well, thank you so much again for your time and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a minute to rate, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. We'll catch you in the next episode.